The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Weasel words, perhaps the annoying linguistic habit that you do, but you don't even know you're doing it, because it seems as though we're hedging our language more than ever. Barry McLaughlin is with us, Head of Client Management at the Communications Clinic, and the linguist at the University of Limerick, Gail Flanagan, is on the line too. Good morning to you both. And Gail, I'll begin with you. What are weasel words in your opinion?
Good morning, Claire. Well, first of all, I loved the expression weasel words. So reading then the article that came out recently, which was talking about, and they said it was expressions with sound but without meaning. I'm completely the opposite on that one. From a linguist's perspective, and from my perspective, these words are words that we include them in our conversations, and they do add meaning. But let's give an example that you could say, shut the door. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, you know, but as opposed to being so direct and saying, shut the door, I'm going to say to you, would you mind shutting the door? So even putting in that would, what I'm doing there is I'm softening, and we talked about hedging, which has been more indirect, and I'm introducing further words, but I'm introducing them to convey the meaning, the politeness to the person, to the listener. So they're very useful words. They're full of meaning. And depending on the relationship that the speaker and the listener have, depends on the inference, depends how much they will understand the politeness norm, and whether that is...
That's key though, isn't it, Gail? Yes. Like, it depends on your setting. So if you're at home with your family, you might tell someone to shut the door. But if you're in work, you'll say, would you mind shutting the door? Because you're watching your P's and Q's a little bit more in that setting, I would imagine.
Exactly. But even things like we'll say, like, would you mind sending an email? You know, I might say that to somebody, one of my team members, or I would have when I was working in industry. They need to send the email. You know, I'm giving them the instruction. And again, I'm just softening it, just to kind of, it's relationship building, and it's not just, you don't just build relationships. It's having, you know, it's continuing with that that relationship in teams, in like in the workplace, for example, and ensuring that you are, you know, expressing solidarity, you know, displaying, look, I'm with you. I know it's going to be, you know, you're going to have to send a difficult email, but, you know, so would you mind?
You see, and the other problem we have with this is that people understand different things from words. Like I said to Anton this morning, if I said to him that there's a realistic possibility of me bringing him a cup of tea, he might think that I'm probably and very likely going to bring him tea some morning. Whereas what I'm thinking is, well, I haven't committed to doing anything here, so you might never see the tea and that would be fine.
Exactly. And that's when a realistic probability, he probably didn't turn around and go, okay, Claire, do you mean 10%, 50% or 80% am I getting this cup of tea? He did not. But he probably, if you were in more formal communication, it'd be interesting to hear what Barry has to say on this. It probably is good not to be as vague in your conversation, not hedging your bets, but to be more explicit in what you're saying. Or perhaps you don't want to be. Perhaps, you know, with you and Anton, it was just a casual chat. You know, you probably weren't even conscious of the words you were using. But in a more formal communication situation, you do need to be cognizant of the words that are what the meaning can potentially convey when you're saying.
So, Barry, if you're communicating for business in a professional capacity, I assume you want people to be as crystal clear as possible.
Absolutely. And I think just something that Gail said there, you know, that it's down to the relationship. And, you know, if you're around people and you know them and you know that you have to moderate your language and use certain words, that's because you have a relationship with these people. The really interesting thing about this article was that I think it was written by an epidemiologist, and he made a point that we understood, and my colleagues understood, that the phrase realistic possibility in our language and in our profession meant a risk of between 40 and 50%. And actually, the author went and then asked people afterwards, 5,000 people, what do you understand by that phrase, realistic possibility? And most people were more optimistic. They actually meant, to use your own example there, Claire, well, actually, I'm more likely to get the cup of tea than I thought I was. So there's that kind of, you know, I think there's a laziness sometimes and maybe a lack of empathy when we're writing or communicating to people. We make assumptions about what they understand and what they know. And I think the first thing in any communication you have to kind of almost get to the end and say, well, right, what do I want people to think or do or remember at the end? And then can I structure my communication or my writing to get that to as quickly and clearly across as possible?
Mm-hmm.
One of the big problems I think a lot of people have now is we're all under time pressure. And I'm sure there's people listening to this discussion. This morning, they turned on their computer, they got an email from a colleague, and you might have to read it twice or three times to figure out, well, actually, what do they want me to do or what's going on?
But the problem is, Barry, that could be intentional. Like saying that something is almost certain, for example, I might want the ambiguity to be there because I don't want to commit to anything.
Yeah, but if you're being ambiguous about your ambiguity, what will people think about you afterwards? Because every time we write something, every time we communicate with someone, we're either building or unbuilding a relationship. People will form a view of us. And if you're, and let's say it's not even done deliberately. Let's say maybe you're not conscious that someone might take a phrase differently or understand a phrase differently. And you don't follow up with people and you don't check in and inquire, was the communication effective? Was it right? That's actually going to have an impact on how you're perceived, your own personal brand, your division, your company. So we see a big push, and it's something that's happened a lot in particularly in government departments, both here and in the UK, striving for plain English, using simple words, using one word instead of three. Because ultimately, anyone reading or paying attention to what you have to say, they're under time pressure as well. Mm-hmm. They've got stuff on their desk. So there's a couple of things that could be really helpful. The American military have an acronym called BLUFF, bottom line up front. And they've worked out that in time-critical communications, you know, people don't have time to stand around the battlefield and scratch their heads and look at a sheaf of papers and go, well, actually, what am I supposed to do here? The instruction or the point or the headline is right up the top. But that takes practice, that takes attention, and that also takes, you know, not being afraid to say, look, maybe the way we're communicating is not working. Because again, in this article, the epidemiologist vastly overestimated the understanding that people had about phrases that he believed conveyed a certain amount of certainty. And that's something we all have to watch. Are we using phrases and words we think are absolutely fine, but might have a completely different meaning to the people we're trying to persuade?
And Gail, for you, I mean, this is often a cultural thing, isn't it? I mean, Americans will hear something and they'll take the optimistic view of it. Irish people, I would imagine, are pretty good at hedging. Like if you admire what somebody's wearing and they tell you, oh, this old thing, I've had it for 10 years and it's hanging off me. Are we especially skilled at this?
We are, particularly in directing our conversation. But I suppose I'll preface this by saying it isn't like you can't say every Irish person has exactly the same kind of manner of conversation in every single conversation and interaction. So there are times where the bluff, and I love that, I've written that down, Barry, the bluff approach, that is what is needed. But it depends on the situation. Whereas when you're chatting, like even yesterday, a senior academic in UL said, well, we kind of won an award. And I looked and kind of thought, no, we did win an award, and it was a significant award, and he was in a position that he was communicating this with pride. But he was putting in that little softener there. He didn't even realise probably that he had used it. So it just depends on the scenario, who we're talking to. The bluff approach, I think, is brilliant. I love it personally. I'm a direct person. But I think you've got to be cognizant of the culture that you're working with. A lot of research shows a lot of research traditionally is on, which is changing, thankfully, I think, but on country-based cultures. But if we look to Asia, traditionally, they would have been known a bit like the Irish for being, I think the Irish are more indirect in our chatting and our story. Storytelling. We can be direct in factual workplace conversations. But even in the workplace, it can be very important if you're dealing, for example, with Japan, to make sure that you open that email with a specific comment on the season and on like the cherry blossom or blooming. Things like that are still happening. These openers. And if we look at emails, you know, we often say, I hope you are well. That seems to have come into general, I don't know, email conversation.
I know, it's awful though. Can we think of something else to open an email with? I know, what else do you say though? You know,
exactly.
It seems quite harsh to say, hello, Gail, and go straight into the ask in the email. So we need to find a new thing, a new opener for our emails that is a bit more inventive and personal.
I know, but then there'll always be something. I mean, I always say to my God, if anybody's listening that works with our family business, they'll know, I'll always say, it's lovely to meet you, meet you online through email. And it is kind of a standard phrase
I have. Well, I suppose it's a bit different to I hope you're well. We have to leave it there, Barry and Gail. Thank you both very much, Barry McLaughlin and Gail Flanagan.
The Clare Byrne Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.